The heart has always been a driver of politics, a source of inner power that gets harnessed for ends that range from good to evil. That power is amplified and released through the experience of heartbreak. But the kind of power generated depends on how the heart breaks, and the elasticity that allows it to break open instead of apart only comes through the exercise of democratic habits of the heart.
Democratic habits of the heart.
I want to begin by backing up a couple of weeks. Those of you who worship with us regularly will remember that Roger, a couple of weeks ago, opened our Wellspring series with a sermon on parents and kids. And then last week he talked a little bit about idolatry. To me, these are related themes, parents and idolatry, because parents so often form our first impressions of God or what is good. As we grow, we learn that our parents are fallible and imperfect beings. We learn that our parents have very special roles in shaping our values, but we also learn that our values and our identity must eventually become something that is internal to us, welled up from below, not cut and pasted from somewhere or someone else. Spiritually, I think we hope to evolve similarly. We hope to come to know the divine personally in our hearts. Beyond the teachings that we receive as children and on through adulthood, we hope that our understanding of the world fills our being from within and calls us to act in the world in accordance with our experiences of beauty and truth and justice. The path toward spiritual maturity, then, is one of external belief giving way to internal feeling, of learning to trust our own moral compass, and of allowing our minds to descend, however slowly, into our hearts. When Roger suggested last week that you use sometimes make an idolatry of reason, this is how I understood his words, that when we allow our minds to descend into our hearts, our beliefs about the world become less important than our feelings for one another. This does not mean an uncritical acceptance of beliefs in favor of heartfelt fervor. Rather, what I mean to imply and recommend is a humble acceptance that our beliefs are not the only ones that matter. Now, before I go on, I want to share an experience with you. Over the years, I've had quite a few opportunities to do ministry with and to youth and young adults, and it can be one of the most fascinating and frustrating experiences, as any parent will know. Because nothing is sacred, nothing is so sacred that it can't be, you know, flipped over and pulled apart and questioned. And while this is challenging for parents or authority figures, it is exhilarating for teachers and ministers. Recently, I was working with a group of young adults who had just convened for the first time. So some of them were new to the group, some of them old, some of them knew one another, some folks knew nobody. And they went around the room introducing themselves and took turns answering a question. The question was, what do you believe? This seems to me like a perfectly logical thing to ask a bunch of Unitarian Universalists, because there's probably a diversity in every room. But I found myself wondering, as I heard the first few responses, when the question of belief became the dominant question of religion. If you've ever identified yourself as a Unitarian Universalist or really anything else, I'll bet maybe the first question you were asked was, oh, and what do you believe? Well, I'm curious, why don't we ask, oh, how do you live your life? Or, what is important to you? How do you live out your ultimate concern, as Roger said last week? Or how is Unitarian Universalism visible in your life and actions? So I listened in this group as each person quite poignantly told the group about their unique view of the world, their beliefs, how the world began, whether they believed in God, and so on. And as I listened, I wondered to myself, what does it mean that we're focusing so much of our time and our identity on our opinions, on what makes us unique as opposed to what we hold in common? From Roger's list of idolatries last week, I hear individualism in a big way here. And I think I might add to that list a stubborn and sometimes counterproductive preference for uniqueness. There's an old rabbinic tale referred to these days as two pockets, if you're looking for it online. It tells us that each person should walk around with two pockets filled. In one pocket should be gold and a note that says, "For my sake, the world was created." In the other pocket is dust and a note that says, "I am but dust and ashes." When we're feeling low, we can draw from the gold and from the words of worth that the world was created for us to enjoy. And when we're feeling high, when we need a little bit of balance, we can temper our egos by remembering our dusty interconnectedness. I think where we UUs often fail is by neglecting to pull out the dust quite enough. We are unique, yes, and worthy, yes, and loved absolutely. But we are also no more unique or worthy or loved than anyone else. And so it's here that I want to begin to talk a little bit about politics, for which I know you will all rejoice. Or more specifically, about the breakdown of our ability to talk about politics in a manner that is worthy of the human spirit. I'm curious, has anyone here heard of the author and writer and speaker Parker Palmer? Anyone? A few folks. Okay. Parker Palmer is a Quaker. Quaker Christian. He is an excellent writer. He's actually based in Madison, which I just learned. He's done a number of programs on WPR, and he's also written a couple of books. His most recent one, I think, is just excellent. I commend it to you highly. And it's called Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit. Parker Palmer writes a lot about living a purposeful, undivided life. He wrote a book called Let Your Life Speak, which I read during a period of great transition in my life. It actually prompted me to go to seminary, which I promise it will not inflict that on all of you if you read it. But he's really an excellent writer. So in this new book, Palmer tells a common but rarely told story today. He suggests that his recent depression is linked to his heartbreak at the state of political discourse. State of hopelessness. I say that his story is a common one because we can see the symptoms of heartbreak everywhere in our social lives, from the politics of rage visible on both the right and the left, to the YouTube video testimonies where young people boldly assert their proud decision to not vote. Occupy Wall Street is another admirable effort, but I do wonder if maybe it's falling on deaf ears. Having been in more than one march or protest that I would have, over the years looking back, considered impotent, I ask again, and admittedly somewhat cynically, what are we as a nation, what are we as individuals to do with our suffering, with our heartbreak? The breakdown of our democracy seems to be running alongside social trends toward more and more isolation. Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, observed years ago a steady decline of civil society. By civil society, I mean sort of opportunities for us to get together, oftentimes across lines of great difference. Putnam's title comes from an observation that people were showing up in greater numbers to bowling alleys alone. You know, where people used to go in leagues or with friends, people were now bowling alone. I invite you to think with me for a moment. Where are opportunities in your life to come together, sometimes across lines of seemingly great distance? Are these opportunities growing or are they diminishing? Putnam's observation, and he's not alone, is that gathering opportunities like bowling leagues or houses of worship are actually pretty important to the development of what he calls social capital. They're opportunities to practice weaving together community from the separate strands of our unique lives. They're opportunities to see what is in common, even across great difference, and to come together in mutual aid and in the joy of discovering something new. My read of bowling alone, especially in view of our current political climate, is that our mutual aid muscles are out of shape from lack of use. It comes as little surprise, then, when we struggle under the weight of sustaining a civil yet effective political discourse. Just a few moments ago, we sang together the words from the hymn, "Far Too Long by Fear Divided." I wonder, fear, belief, identity, what is it that keeps us divided? Divided from others, divided even from ourselves. Whatever the names of your dividers, there is something that we all have in common, our division. And we all have experienced some heartbreak, I think, around the state of our political union these days. For some of us, things have been especially bad of late. For others, they were worse a few years ago. But our commonality, our point of real solidarity, is our heartbreak itself. It is the fact that no matter what, our political system continues to fail to live up to our ideals, just as youthful views of our parents likely did, just as our youthful views of God did. Just as our parents are flawed people, just as we are flawed people, so we are governed by flawed people. We do have a tool in our political system, however, that we do not have in our families: democracy. When this country was forged out of broken hearts and courage 200 plus years ago, it was done so with the general knowledge that people would forever disagree. Our model of government was not forged to repel disagreement and tension, but rather to harness the creative power in that tension and put it to use in serving the common good. Thomas Jefferson's words, "Dissent is the highest form of patriotism," provide the philosophical foundation for our government. The greatest insult to the spirit of democratic freedom is the belief that there is, was, or ever will be a singular truth. And this is where the political becomes a religious issue in my mind. There can be no singular truth so long as the divine makes itself known to each of us through unique ways in the experiences of our lives. We are not a nation because we believe the same thing. We are not united by belief, just as this fellowship is not united by belief, just as that group of young people was not united by belief. We're a nation because we've agreed to be a certain way with each other. And this way assumes at its core that each person has the opportunity and responsibility to make sense of their life as they would see fit. The central idea here, present in both American democracy and in our UU tradition, is covenant. We are a tradition bound by covenant, a covenant forged by our creation and interpreted politically by immigrants to this country in the 17th century. Many of these immigrants who were fleeing centralized religious authority in England and Poland convened in their new land in a new way, one that would never become the politics of domination that they were fleeing. Their way of convening is evident in the Mayflower Compact of 1620, in the Cambridge Platform of 1648, which still founds the basis of how our congregations relate to one another as Unitarians. And eventually, some 100 plus years later, in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Our system of government, therefore, grew out of a pre-political awareness, a heartfelt religious sense that freedom and communal commitment were somehow related, and that we, the people, would never make any sense without ensuring equal voices for all. We could even say that the Constitution proceeded from a pre-political brokenheartedness, a remembrance of when families' lives and faith had been forcibly twisted by political and religious authority. Aware of their own suffering, then, aware of being held under another's boot, they sought, as parents often do, to never revisit the harms of the past on the promise of the future. This promise is the promise of democracy, a heart that is destined again and again and again to be broken and mended anew. Just as in parenting, just as in faith, just as in life, really. If we are indeed destined to be brokenhearted, if you agree with me that these tensions are inevitably, at least on their surface, disappointing, then what does this mean for a community of faith such as ours? Does it mean that we seek to stop the heartache? Maybe. To me, however, this would be akin to seeking to stop the pain of death by stopping death itself. Not only is it unrealistic, it actually extends our suffering infinitely by pitting us against our nature. Democracy helps us to challenge constantly to detach ourselves from our own preferential vision of how the world works, to develop structures that, be they religious or political, are flexible enough to embrace life's constantly changing nature and the deluge of inconsistencies and contradictions that come along with it. This was the spirit of the Europeans who settled here hundreds of years ago. It was the spirit of how they organized their spiritual lives and how they eventually organized their political lives. It's the same pluralistic spirit that organizes us as Unitarian Universalists today. I want to introduce to you a story from the Hasidic tradition, one that Parker Palmer uses to illustrate his view of heartbreak. One day, a young disciple approaches an old rabbi. The boy asks the old rabbi, "Rabbi, why does Torah tell us to place these words upon our hearts? Why does it not tell us to place these holy words in our hearts?" The wise rabbi answers, "It's because as we are, our hearts are hardened and closed, and we cannot place the holy words in our hearts. So we place them on top of our hearts, and there they stay until one day the heart breaks and the words fall in." This same point is made by the Sufi master Hazrat Inayat Khan, who says, "God breaks the heart again and again and again until it stays open." Suffering is what prompted the Buddha to search and to meditate. And in Christianity, the way to know the heart of God is by looking faithfully and honestly at the tragedy and promise of Jesus' crucifixion. The point of all these understandings of suffering is one that Parker Palmer makes from his own life with eloquence and courage. Speaking as someone who struggled with depression more than once, he reminds us that hearts can break in more than one way. Hearts can shatter, that kind of break that casts our sense of community and self into a million tiny pieces that we often try feebly to gather for the rest of our lives. Or hearts can break open, allowing us greater empathy for those who around us struggle still. The first kind of break calls us down a rabbit hole of personal pain and history, the second toward a healing vision for the future. Unitarian writer and activist Henry David Thoreau, who wrote about the economy in the classic text Walden in 1835, said this. He said, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. A stereotyped but unconscious despair is concealed even under what are called the games and amusements of mankind." End quote. I suggest that these games and amusements have been around forever, and they likely will be around forever. And so my question again is, how might we focus on healing the despair beneath them? How might we as a Unitarian Universalist religious community address the despair, the suffering, and the heartbreak in our midst? I have two suggestions for us today as faithful and practicing Unitarian Universalists. And there they are, faithful and practicing. The first is, we must remain faithful. I'm aware that faith is not an easy word for some of you use to hear, let alone to accept as personally important, because it has become largely synonymous with an uncritical acceptance of dogmatic external religion. But that's not the way in which I mean it today. Faith can also be understood as how we make sense of the dual reality of being born and knowing that one day we will die. This reality is the ultimate root of all of our more or less trivial heartbreaks along the way. Faith, then, is what allows us to step from beneath the crushing weight of fearing death into appreciation of life and beauty. Faith is what allows us to love deeply and courageously with all of our beings, knowing full well that the object of our love will eventually die, and so will we. Faith is what we find when we look back to times when we thought we wouldn't make it, or when we found help when we thought there was none, or when we were offered the love of another without anything asked in return. We find faith only by first having lived courageously without it. So when I think about this politically, this calls me to stand on the bedrock of our liberal religious tradition. Our theological inheritance, I think, is something quite amazing. We're here because of the actions of women and men who throughout history believe that, one, we are all worthy and beloved on the earth, and two, we are no more worthy or beloved than anyone else. We are gold and we are dust. Our tradition is full of brave souls who stood for the right to speak and also the right for each to be heard. The theological roots of the covenantal promise of American democracy have been present in our tradition for hundreds of years. They were the inheritance of Unitarian forefathers Adams and Jefferson and others, and they are our inheritance today. This is a fact long forgotten by those who most loudly claim the forefathers as their own and who seek to avoid the unpleasantness of history's contradictions in order to support their own triumphant story. But the forefathers were not perfect. They knew this. They knew this when they created our system of government. Faith in perfection has never been a necessity of faith in things as they are, or as they may someday be. Such is the promise of our tradition, a promise flexible and elastic enough to handle heartbreak. We teach our children values and integrity here. We teach them that they are valued and that others are too. We teach them to communicate, to bravely ask for help when they need it. We teach them to be curious, especially in the face of fear. We even teach them to be democratic as a matter of faith, to practice democratic habits of the heart. These things we teach our children, that our teachings may be laid over their hearts, so when their hearts do break, as they inevitably will, and likely more than once, they may break further open. And even amidst their heartache, they will know themselves beloved and valued. And all of that good stuff about equality and compassion will sink in a little deeper. This is how we grow our hearts as UUs, and how we may eventually come to find faith as one. Watch our tradition save lives with a message of love. See it again and again as I have, and I dare you to call it anything but faith. My second point is what I would see as the social expression of the first. If faith is what we do as individuals, then practice is what we do to take our place within the whole. Personal practices like meditation, prayer, yoga, communion with nature, these are daily ways that we reimagine ourselves as part of something larger. If you're interested in developing a practice like this, I encourage you to come talk to either of our ministers. But today, I want to especially lift up our group practice, what we're doing right now. And I'm not referring to fighting off sleep. Just kidding. Worship services are opportunities to participate in something larger than ourselves. This is true of any tradition, really. But our tradition's practice is especially close to our topic today, democracy. Because when we gather, we do so with an understanding that no person's voice is more important than another. This congregation offers a time of congregational response for precisely this reason. This congregation is governed by an elected board, in essence a representative democracy. And our clergy understand their calls as both divine and at the same time very much particular to a group of people, you all. This is evident in our contracts and, I hope, in our interactions. We are not greater than anyone we serve, and we do not have any formal theological power. Rather, we're called into service as the curators of the spiritual lives of our neighbors, in accordance with a tradition of doing so that spans thousands of years. Collectively, we understand rituals like marriages and child dedications and new member joinings to be expressions of voluntary commitments of imperfect beings working toward a world transformed by our love. We understand this kind of voluntary commitment to one another as perhaps the highest form of human activity, so much higher than belief. And we practice it in our congregations each time we gather. I'm going to close today by suggesting that our problem that we face together as a nation, as a people of this planet, is not that the wrong people are in charge. After all, as the poet said, the bastards and the good guys are always getting shuffled. Our problem today is that our democratic system itself is in need of repair. And what I want to suggest to you, pretty strongly actually, is that we have within our midst and our tradition the capacity to transform heartbreak into healing and suffering into compassion. We have the capacity to organize our unique individual energies into effective expressions of common concern. We have the vision, both historical and futuristic, to call democracy back again and again to its highest form. Together, we can heal this politics of brokenheartedness, if only we begin to see it as such.